Welcome to the Talk of Gasoline Alley, race week in Indianapolis, with Donald Davidson, the historian of the 500 and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. I'm Kevin Lee. Donald, we should be ready to go. We've already done two practice shows today to get warmed up. Those will be our email shows that will air tomorrow night and Thursday night. And I've sent emails to everyone whose questions we got to, so you know to make sure you find that podcast. And unfortunately, there's just not enough time in the day. We're working on cloning Donald to be able to do multiple shows like that and get all the questions through. Tonight, phone calls. Wednesday night will be phone calls as well at 317-239-1070 is the telephone number. And Terry from Columbus, Ohio starts us off first. Hello, Terry.
Hello. Good evening, gentlemen. Bless you both. Bless Dave for marrying the late, great John Tesmer and everyone coming to the race. Went to the AJ exhibit last week at the Grand Prix weekend.
Yep.
And I noticed the name on a lot of the photographs that I hadn't thought about for a long time. I believe the photographer, Glenn Benegar. So what do you know about him, if anything?
Oh, I knew Glenn Benegar. He was not a professional photographer. He did that as a hobby. He was involved in the meat business somehow, and I don't remember how. I know that he used to, I think he was sort of like a wholesale meat distributor or something like that, but he was a big race fan, and he not only did his own photography, but he did his own developing, and he did those, he had a color developer. And that's at a time, golly, I remember probably early to mid-70s, and maybe earlier than that even, he was doing his own color developing. And he would do these huge blow-ups and mount them on board. And then the signature was the name in cursive and in gold would be down in one corner. And I don't know that he ever sold a picture. I think he just gifted them to everybody, and you know, he was very fond of the Unsers and Foyt and just about everybody. And there's a lot of Glenn Benegar pictures out there. And as again, I mean, he may have sold a picture from time to time, but I'm not aware that he ever did. I think he gave it all away.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. Before we continue, something I had on my mental list of to-dos. He mentioned the museum, so let's mention what you're going to be doing and why we taped tomorrow's show already because of your activities tomorrow night.
Yes, in conjunction with Amos, there's a program going out, the part of the speaker series at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Museum, and we're doing a program tomorrow night with Al Unser Jr. and Scott Goodyear and maybe some other surprise guests that were part of that amazing 1992 finish, which, believe it or not, was 25 years ago. So Little Al, as he likes to be called, and Scott Goodyear will be there. And I think the doors open at 6, I believe. And then the program is due to start at 6:30. And I think we're probably going to go about an hour or so. Yeah, why not bet? We'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
And so we're blessed to moderate. I know those two have worked together before, but that's something I've always wanted to do, is just sit with the two of them and talk about the 92 finish from their perspective.
I ran into Scott today at the track, and this came up. So yes. I asked him a few things about that since I can't go tomorrow night, and he told me something about 92 that I did not know, that I won't mention here, that it might be shared tomorrow night that will explain some things. So it was really, really interesting. So
I've got another question now. I can say, what was it you told Kevin Lee that we didn't know?
He told me a couple of things, but he you know, and maybe people knew this, but I had forgotten about it if I didn't know it. Just explaining, well, how did you finish second in this race? How are you so good when you got bumped from the field?
Yeah.
And there was some circumstances that I'm sure that you know, but he'll explain to people tomorrow night. So we'll look forward to hearing that. All right, back to the phones we go. And Jonathan is up next in Chicago, I think. Hi, Jonathan.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
I was wondering if you could do a profile on Billy Arnold. You know, he's one of my favorites. He came to the track, dominated, and then just vanished.
He did.
And maybe you can talk about his appearance in the film, The Crowd Roars.
Okay. Yes, absolutely. In fact, we did. We talked about Billy Arnold in an earlier show, but happy to do it again, and I'll probably handle it just a little bit differently. He was from Chicago, South Side, and one of our callers, David, I have not got back to him, and he thought that I might be a little mistaken with some information I gave out the other night, so I'm going to defend myself and say that Billy Arnold was from, his address was 5710 Wentworth Avenue, and that is a street that goes north and south. And if you go and try and find his house, it's not there because the freeway, the Dan Ryan Express, now runs through there. And if you get off at, I think you can get off at 57th or 58th or whatever it is, but if you go down Wentworth, which is right next to the freeway, there are now, I think there's still a few buildings on the east side. There used to be several houses, but now there might be a couple, not too much there. But on the west side of the street, there's no houses because that's where the bank goes down to where the freeway is. So I tell people when you're going north on the Dan Ryan Express, just before you get to 57th Street, you just went under. You didn't go under the house. You went under where the house used to be, or at least virtually. But he was, he started driving dirt tracks. He ran in the Midwest. There's a photograph of him taken at a track that I don't know if it was ever identified. But anyway, he's in this photograph with Wilbur Shaw, Louis Schneider, Dutch Bowman, and is there somebody else? There's a mystery character, but at least four of them went on to drive in the Indianapolis 500, and three of them won. So anyway, he had five starts. The call is quite correct. He just wasn't around for very long. Had five starts and drove for Mike Boyle in 28th and 29th. And finished 7th in 28 with Bill Spence as a relief driver, and 8th in 29 with Fred Roberts from Danville, Illinois, and Cliff Woodbury from Chicago as relief drivers. And then in 1930, 31, and 32, he drove for Harry Hart. So if we've got a few moments here, I'll tell a couple of things that I did not say on the first night, or maybe I was just rushed a little bit. So Harry Hart's great board track driver, national champion 1926, three-time runner-up in the 500, the only person to this date that finished second three times and did not have a win to go along with the three runner-up positions. There are other three-time runners-up, but they all had at least one win. Anyway, Harry was a great qualifier, too. He never qualified worse than fourth, I don't think, from 22 through 27. But then in 1927, later on, at Salem, New Hampshire, board track, he was severely injured. So he planned to come back in 1930. And a car was built, front drive, Miller Hart special. And so he starts out practicing. And he had Ralph Hepburn standing by as a potential relief driver. And so he would run practice and see if he felt that he was up to it. And he still wasn't quite sure. And so Billy Arnold, who didn't have a ride, then came into the mix as well. And after trying the two of them to decide who would be his relief driver, he settled on Billy Arnold. And apparently it was because Ralph Hepburn wanted to make some changes or was making suggestions. And Billy Arnold was saying, gee, Mr. Hart, yes, sir, whatever you want, I'll do whatever you want. And then also apparently I'll get to the next part in a few moments. But Harry Hart actually went out to make a qualifying attempt on the first day of qualifications, did a lap of 110, maybe a couple of laps, and then he came in and thought, legs hurting too badly, I can't do it, and he turned it over to Billy Arnold, and then Billy Arnold put it on the pole. But I think that's the only time in history that somebody won the pole with a car that had waved off earlier in the day with another driver. So anyway, Billy Arnold won the pole, and then proceeded to dominate the race. Louis Meyer, in the middle of the front row, led the first two laps, and then Billy Arnold took over from the third lap and was never headed after that. So he led 198 consecutive laps. Total number of lead changes in the race, one. And so, and he won, he was about, I think he won by about 7 minutes or so over the combination of Shorty Cantlin and Herman Schurz, which finished second. And yes, they completed 200 laps, but it was about 7 minutes. I think when Billy Arnold took the flag, took the checker, Shorty Cantlin, I think, had five laps to go. So anyway, Billy Arnold goes on to win the national championship that year. With I think he won two races at the Altoona board track, and it wasn't a very long season by then. The board tracks were starting to go by the wayside because of upkeep, and I think this is probably going to be a two-parter. Do we need to make this a two-parter?
Do you need more than another minute and a half?
Oh, are you serious?
I'm sorry, that was a silly question.
Silly question.
We have until 9 o'clock, and Donald will be done by then, and then we'll address more questions. Stay with us. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Before we get back to the phone lines, I'm Kevin Lee. Donald Davidson is here to continue from the last segments.
Arnold was the national champion, 500 winner and national champion in 1930, dominating the 30 race with 198 out of the 200 laps. So 31, he comes back, wins the pole again at, I think, 113 miles an hour. But the run was disallowed because there was something to do with, I think, the rear brakes weren't connected or something. It was some kind of a technical issue that caused them to disallow the run so that he would have to come back on the second day. This time he qualified at 116, which was 3 miles an hour faster than the previous day, but he had to start 18th. It took him seven laps to get to the front, and from that point on he was not headed until the 161st lap or 162nd lap, when he crashed while leading by about 5.5 laps over the second place car. So anyway, I don't know that he ran very many other races, but he did come back in 1932, did not win the pole, came close. Lou Moore won the pole, and I think led the first two laps, and then Billy Arnold took over, I think, on the third lap, maybe. And that led until he was involved in another accident. The 1931 was coming through turn four. The 1932 accident, a car got a little squirrely in front of him, and he took evasive action and hit the turn two wall and went over the just north of where the Speedway Motel now, or the Brickyard Crossing, I'm sorry, to some of it will always be the Speedway Motel. Anyway, he received injuries. He and the riding mechanic, Spider Matlock, who was a Hollywood stuntman, a member of the 13 Flying Black Cats stunt group. There were some really colorful characters that were drivers and riding mechanics in those days. And just as in 1931, the two of them were injured. Billy Arnold had just got married. Apparently, the new wife wasn't very crazy about racing, and so he retired. But he became involved in business, and he had a long relationship with Chrysler. And let's see, was it DeSoto? I think it was DeSoto, but I could be wrong on that. But anyway, he was a field rep for a major car maker. And then during the war, he was in Europe and became a lieutenant colonel and was the head of more than a motor pool. It was an entire division. And I forget the place in England where he was stationed now. But anyway, he didn't drive again. And then after the war, he came back and ended up in Oklahoma City, where he became a contractor, did a lot of interesting stuff that he did, but he built like shopping centers and stuff like that. I never met him. I would like to, but apparently he changed quite a bit in personality. As the caller referenced, he does appear in The Crowd Roars, which was made in the winter of 1931-32, And he has a cameo role. In fact, he has two cameo roles. And he was a pretty good actor. And there's a part where James Cagney, the supposed race driver trying to make the comeback, is walking up and down the pits at Indianapolis, which is actually Legion Ascot in California, but that's okay. It was made up to look like Indianapolis. And when he comes across Billy Arnold sitting on the wall, and they do an upside-down handshake. It was like what the beatniks were doing in the 50s, the 50s and 60s, where you actually hold the hand up in the air. And so instead of I don't know if you could describe it better than I can, instead of a regular handshake, it was one of these with like a hand clasp up in the air.
Okay.
I got one of those when I met Troy Donahue, which has got nothing to do with this, except I've just sort of, I don't get a chance to gloat that I met Troy Donahue once. But anyway, Billy Arnold was a pretty good actor. And a very, you know, pretty much of a backslapper and got along with all the big wigs in industry. But according to several people, he sort of went a personality change during the war, and that when he was military, he was very military. And anybody that would run into him over there that had been involved in racing, and if they tried to be palsy-wowsy with him, they were quickly rebuffed. And there was some his date of birth kept changing, and somebody suggested, in fact, a wife suggested that he was 19 when he won the race in 1930. I think he was 24. And anyway, he died in 1976. And he came to Indianapolis in 46 and 51, and then I think 55, and not after that, in May. Member of the 100-mile-an-hour club, one of the first qualifiers for that, and would wear the bomber jacket and everything like that. But the last time he came to Indianapolis, Harry Hart told me that it was around Christmas time one year, probably early 70s, and there was a military reunion at Fort Ben. And Billy Arnold was in town just very, very briefly, called Harry Hart. And I would like to have met him, but maybe it would be a disappointment because apparently he was a little gruff in the later years.
Hmm. Okay, thank you. Let's go back to the telephones. And Rick is with us next from Cleveland. Hi, Rick. You're up with Donald.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for calling.
Donald, last year with 100th, it was such a big, big celebration, so special, so important. I'm just wondering what your favorite occurrence, what your favorite impression of it was.
Oh, of the, golly, I really like when the winners go out on the backs of the pace cars. There was a lot of really great things that happened, but a great moment for me, as I say, is race morning when the retired or winners that are not driving in the race, many of them show up and they get on the back of the pace cars. And as I requested the first year that they did it, please don't put a bunch of them in one car or on a float or anything like that. One per car, please. And off they go. And it's Foyt. And it's Parnelli, and it's Mario, and it's Rick Mears, and it's Al Unser, and it's Rutherford and Bobby Unser. And to hear the cheers from the stands when those cars go out onto the track, that's about it for me. I wish it was a little closer to the start, but there's so many other things to get in. And then when those cars come back, several of those drivers have duties and have to go off because they're car owners or Rick Mears is a spotter for Penske team and so on and so forth. But then there's some of the others then immediately get in to one of the vintage cars that is going to run, and they're going to do that again this year. But anyway, I think there was a lot of wonderful things. There was a great buzz. I remember thinking, because there was so much build up and so much buzz going, and a week out, I remember it looked like the forecast was not going to be very, very good. It looked like it was going to be 4 days of frustration. Mm. And by golly, the thing cleared up, and about 7:30, in the Plaza area on race morning. There was probably more people than I'd seen on race day in many, many years.
Yes, that's what impressed me the most, was the I've never seen so many people at that track. You know, there are some naysayers out there that say, well, with the millennial generation, they just sit at home with their smartphones, and they're not into all forms of racing like prior generations. Well, you show those people overhead shots of the track on race day. I've never seen so many people at that track, and it was just so special, so important. And, of course, now we have another reigning, another Formula One, former yep. Formula One champion here, so the greatness continues.
Well, I would look for a huge crowd this week because of the very reason that you mentioned. There was a buzz anyway, and then when Alonso was announced as coming here, I thought, boy, that's going to be huge, and I think it will turn out to be. So thank you.
Thank you for the call, Rick. Mike in Vernon Hills is next up with Donald. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, Mike. Hi, gentlemen. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Hey, as we're getting down the home stretch here, I just want to thank you and Kevin for some great shows this year. It really makes the month of May.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. I wonder, Donald, if tonight you could profile driver Johnny McDowell.
Yeah, I don't know if I've had that one before. Maybe I have. Johnny McDowell was actually born in DeKalb, Illinois, but was listed as Pasadena, California. I don't look this stuff up. I'm hazy on the recent years, but I can still do this stuff. Pasadena, I believe, is where he was listed. Anyway, he came back to the Midwest, he'd actually raced in the Pacific Northwest. When he started coming into his own as a young man, the Legion Ascot Speedway closed up. And in January of 1936. And so there were a number of drivers that had run Ascot, went up and ran in the Pacific Northwest, Seattle, and a bunch of tracks up in Washington State. And Johnny McDowell was one of those. And then in 1937, he came back to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and he was a riding mechanic in 1937. For Frank Wern, who was a West Coast driver who was in that last group that I mentioned. He was an Ascot driver, and then he started running in the Pacific Coast Northwest after Ascot closed. Anyway, so McDowell was a riding mechanic in the 1937 race, and then he shortly dropped out of AAA and then started running CSRA, Central States Racing Association. And golly, I think he was fourth in points in 37. I hadn't thought about this for a while. Anyway, he ran CSRA, which was a real hotbed of sprint car racing that was centered around Dayton, Ohio. He did finish. I think he finished third in points one year. Anyway, then after the war, he was one of the leading drivers in driving midgets. During the huge boost in popularity for about 3 or 4 years of midget racing all over across the country, but including the West Coast. And then his tenure at Indianapolis, I'll speed it up here a little bit, 1949 through 1952. And he drove the Itting Special, never had a finish, drove the Itting Special in 49 and finished 18th. In 51, he drove the Maserati that was the Wilbur Shaw winner, now called the WJ Special, and W stood for Roger Walcott and Sylvester Johnson, who was a banker. And then in 1952, he drove for Roger Walcott. The car was called the McDowell Special, but he didn't own it. Anyway, he didn't finish any of these races. And then he lost his life right after the 52 500. Milwaukee was the next race, but it was dirt in those days. And he was fatally injured in a qualification run. But anyway, he was a very good friend of Henry Banks, among others. And as I mentioned, the hotbed of racing being out in the West Coast, there was also a very strong group. It was AAA, but there was a lot of midget racing in the Midwest. And there was so much that they could, and you've probably heard this line many, many times, you could run every night of the week, mm-hmm. and then on Sunday afternoon. And so there was like a round robin type of thing, and I don't remember exactly what track was which, but they had Anderson, they had West 16th Street Speedway across from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and they had Stadium in St. Louis, Rockford, Illinois, and I don't remember the others, but there was like seven tracks, and they ran on the same night or day of the week every week. So every Tuesday night, hypothetically, was Anderson. Wednesday was 16th Street. I'm not saying that was it. That's hypothetical. And so they towing around all over the place, and Johnny McDowell is the person who thought he got the map out and figured out where would be the most economical place to live so that you could go to all of these events and be back and sleep in your own bed. And it was up by Lake Schaefer. I'm not sure if it was Monticello proper, but Lake Schaefer. And so he set up camp there. And at one time, there was about 30 drivers that all lived up there during the summer. And they sort of made a wagon wheel out of the circuit, with Lake Schaefer being in the middle. And so many, many years later, Henry Banks is deceased. Johnny McDowell had lost his life in 52. And the two boys, Johnny McDowell's son and John Banks, the son of Henry, were little boys that grew up together because their dads were friends. And so now John Banks is deceased. Now, I'm not sure if Johnny McDowell Jr. is still around or not, but a few years ago, they were talking, but this is probably 12, 13, 14 years ago. They're back here in May, and they said, "Do you remember the buried treasure?" And they said, "Yes." They said, "I wonder if it's still there." So they got in the car, and they drove up to Lake Schaefer one day in May, and they walked around and said, "Look, yes, look, the trees are still here, and there's that, and this is this reference point, and that's that reference point." So they got out. I don't know what they used for a trowel, but they started to dig. And this lady came out of her house and just sort of with a quizzical look on her face. And they dug down and they found a jar with that was their buried treasure. And they had like a couple of coins in there and baseball cards and stuff like that. But all those years later, they were both probably, mid-60s at the time, and dug this thing out just like a couple of kids. So, anyway, that's Johnny McDowell.
Mike, thank you for the call. More questions for Donald coming up on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Quick question via email that I had left over that I think you can handle pretty quickly from our friend IndyCar UK, Adrian in the UK. It's a question about the media center, and it's in reference to the boards that are displayed in the media center. He wants to know who does them, how long have they been done. I know who used to do them, and I'll show you real quick. We're talking about the things that Bill York wrote, and I don't know if Bill still does that.
I don't know. Do they still do that on
Qualifying?
That's
what I don't know if they still do
I
or not.
I don't remember seeing them this year. I was up there, of course.
And it's a lot harder to do now with the multiple attempts and everything, but that was a great tradition where... I'll let you explain it.
Well, it was Bob Laycock that did them for years.
Okay.
And what's the measurement? Golly, probably...
Oh, like an 11x17 card, or maybe even bigger than that.
I think bigger than that.
Yeah.
And he would take felt tip pens, there was different colors for the different days, I think, when we had the four qualifying days. And they would just simply slide the cards in, and three rows high, and they just slide the cards in. Now, let's see. I'm trying to think. There would be different colors. There would be blue, and...
That was the four-lap average.
Okay, and then there was black, and then there was red on there as well. And did he change it for different days, I think? But anyway, so they would slide in because the lineup would change. And once the field was full, then the slowest qualifier would come out. And if that was a first-day qualifier, that was that would require a you'd have to pull one out of the middle of the pack or up near the towards the front and then move everything up one. But anyway, he had extremely neat handwriting.
I mean, just looking at it. It's like a calligraphy type, you know.
Well,
just very...
the Bob Laycock's handwriting, I mean, when he printed, they were beautifully, beautiful numbers.
Uh-huh.
And so he did that for years. And then I'm not sure who did it after that.
I thought Bill was doing it in recent years.
Was it Bill York? It could be.
You know, in the last few years now. Adrian was here last year in the media center, and that's the picture that he sent me. So as recently as last year.
All right, then.
They were doing that. Let me look. Yeah, because it.
Well, I certainly didn't.
It shows James Hinchcliffe on the pole.
All right. Well, okay then. It's changed a little bit this year, and with the moving of the interview room from the ground floor up to on the fourth floor, I'm not sure if they did away with that. I certainly didn't recall seeing it this year.
I was in there today, and I didn't notice it, but. Sometimes I'm not very perceptive. I'm kind of focused on the task at hand, but just wanted to share that in case you had any insight. But that's always been something I've always just enjoyed, looking at that and wishing that I could write with such skill and just kind of appreciating the penmanship.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, back to the phone lines we go. And Mark has been waiting in Plainfield, just west of here. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Donald.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, I unfortunately missed you talking about Peter Revson the other day, but
no, it's on. I feel it's going to be on either tomorrow or Thursday's show. I'm just sense that it'll be on later this week.
Well, seeing that McLaren car made me think of them because he and Mark Donohue were my two favorite drivers as a kid, and I wondered if one you could talk a little about Mark Donohue and anything you might want to add about Peter. But something I found out recently was. Peter Revson's girlfriend, Marjorie Wallace, from here in Indianapolis. If you have anything to add about her, if you know anything about her.
A little bit, yes. She got in. Well, in fact, Kevin, maybe you could answer this one.
Well, this is kind of, we're going back in time or forward in time, but when we taped earlier today talking about Peter Revson, you mentioned her. And then, as I always do, I do a little Google search, and actually, I still have it up. She was an actress from Indianapolis who was a contestant for, I think, a Miss Universe and some other things like that, and was on some TV shows like Beretta, and also she apparently was friendly with Jimmy Connors, the tennis star, and some other people that you may have heard of. She was... in 1981, one of the first co-anchors of the television show Entertainment Tonight.
Yeah.
She was...
I think she won a major contest. She won a contest in London. Missed something or other. But anyway, he met her. She was from Indianapolis, and Peter Revson apparently met her in a Hook's drugstore, as I recall.
She dated Tom Jones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she did win one of the big beauty contests. She was the first American to be crowned Miss World.
Okay.
And that was in London.
Yeah.
It was in London.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Well, I'll tell you, I've told this story a number of times, but not this year. In 1971, Bruce McLaren was now deceased, and the 1971 McLaren cars looked markedly different from the ones from 1970, and they were awfully close to a Lotus. Anyway... was at the M16, I think. There were three of them for Team McLaren, and they had sold a car to Roger Penske. And Penske took that. Luigi Lazowski did some work on it. It got Penske-ized. And then during practice in 1971, Donohue was almost 10 miles an hour above the official track record, which was like 171. And he was, in fact, he got up almost to 181. And it's, I can't really tell this story simply and have it make any sense, but there was a rule then that any aerodynamic device had to be an integral part of the body. And McLaren found a way to sneak in a wing on the back of what they called their engine cover, which was a plate that sat on top of the engine. It wasn't a cover at all. It was like about 3 or 4 inches across, and the length of the engine sat on top of the engine. It had this wing. So when they showed up for tech, and the United States Auto Club officials said, well, you can't run that because it's a wing. And they said, but it's an integral part of the body. And they passed off that plate as their engine cover. And USAC tech committee was sort of caught in a corner. And so they said, OK, so the thing goes out. And Donahue with the Penske car, just they only had the one car that started to go, you know, every day it went faster and faster and faster. So with a practice speed of almost 181, it comes time for qualifying. And Donahue drew, I think, fifth position, I think. It seemed he was one of the first cars to go out. And so the crowd are ready for a 180-mile-an-hour run, as described by Tom Carnegie. And to their disappointment, it's only 176, and there was a lap and maybe two laps at 177. But I remember that there was almost no noise at all. It was just like everybody was expecting. It broke the track record by 5-6 miles an hour, but it's not what they were expecting. So anyway, qualifying continues on. Donahue is clearly very down in his post-race, post-qualification interview, probably with Jim Phillippe. Car after car goes out, and nobody tops Donahue's time. And then way down at the end of the line, there's Peter Revson with one of the Works McLarens. Dennis Holm is in the other one. And when Revson goes out, as I think one of the last people in the draw, so this is like an hour and a half or something after Donahue's run, and then to everyone's amazement, and then the crowd got going because Peter Revson proceeded to break Donahue's new track records. And did... let's see, he did like 178 with a lap or two at 179. And so anyway, it came out like that was a huge upset. I mean, that's one of the biggest unexpected things, because Revson was running quickly, but he wasn't somebody that you looked at to get the pole. And, knocked Donahue off the pole. So it turns out that after Donahue was done with all of the interviews down at in the interview area where they start south of the start finish line where they pose for the photos, he starts walking back up the line and comes across the McLaren team with Peter Revson sitting on the front tire, and so they'd known each other for years in sports cars. And so Revson says, what happened? And Donahue said, well, we had a disagreement this morning over a setup, and I asked for a setup, and Penske guys wouldn't give it to me. And so apparently Revson then asked, because he's got pretty much the same thing, the Donahue car is a McLaren, which is virtually the same thing that the factory, that the team is running. So anyway, he said, well, you know, what setup did you want? And apparently Donahue proceeded to tell him. And as soon as he left, Revson says, hey, Kev, boys, gather around. And then he tells what Donahue just told him. And apparently that's what was dialed into the car. And then Revson went and knocked Donahue off the pole, which is one of the greatest stories, I think, in the history of the track.
Thank you for the question. More with Donald coming up on the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Right back at it, and Paul and Racine has been hanging on. Thanks for your patience, Paul.
Hello.
Hello, Paul. I don't know if we got to all the way through whatever you asked us yesterday, but anyway, go ahead.
Oh, you know what? I just saw what your topic is. I may ask you to change it up because we talked about George Bignotti.
Yes.
That'll be on Thursday's show. So if you have another idea, if you want to think on it, I can put you right back on hold.
Well, that's fine. The other comment or person I wanted Donald to talk about was Johnny Capels.
Okay.
Okay, Johnny Capels was the chief mechanic for Joe Leonard in winning the national championship in 1971 and 1972 for Val Spinelli-Jones as Alonso's teammate. What George Bignotti did was would be co-chief on all of the cars with an individual assigned to each driver. And so Johnny Capels had Joe Leonard. Johnny Capels had been on the Vels team, or at least working for Bignotti, since about 68, I think. In fact, he was a driver. He was from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And he came back and drove sprint cars and actually won a feature at Hamburg, New York in 1970. And so he stayed with that he worked on the dirt cars with Mario and Al Unser, the Viceroy cars. And then by 75, he'd gone to Alex. I think he was with Alex Morales by then. I'm just trying to put that one together. Certainly 76 and 77 with Bobby Olivero. And Mike Mosley in 1978. That was an amazing one with Mike Mosley. Poor Bobby Olivero had a problem getting up to speed. He'd qualified in it in 76 and got bumped. Driven in the 77 race, his only start, finished 25th. One of a lot of people that drove in the Indianapolis 500 at one time. And in 78, he was back. Alex, excellent food special. And he had difficulty in getting up to speed. And on the last day, they put Mike Mosley in the car. And Mosley qualified with virtually no practice. I think he went out on Sunday morning and did about four or five laps and then said, I'm ready to qualify. Anyway, there were several great years with Vukovic. And I'm just sort of kind of cramming a bunch of stuff in here. Pancho Carter in dirt cars, but then also at the Speedway. And sixth in 80, and then third in 82 with Pancho. And then later on he had the Alfa Romeo team in 1989, but they ended up not running at Indianapolis. Anyway, then he became involved in CART as not only as an official. I think he was the president of CART for 1 year, and then he left there and then came and was at USAC for a number of years, now retired. But anyway, he grew up with the Unsers, and it was pretty interesting that it's been a while since a chief mechanic at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway was also out running sprint cars with a mm-hmm. feature win in the same year.
Thank you for the question. We'll finish on this. I saw this tweeted today, and it's interesting and topical. Nick Yeoman actually tweeted this, and he actually said, I need to ask Donald Davidson if an Indy 500 pole-sitting car has ever looked as different on post-qual picture day as it will on race day this year. And Nick, for those that don't know, works on IndyCar Radio with us, and it's the picture today of Scott Dixon next to the NTT data car, and that was the way it was painted up yesterday. And we have known for a few days that Camping World is now going to become the primary sponsor of that car, and that was announced today. We often see new paint schemes show up on Carb Day for cars that didn't have sponsorship.
Normally further back in the pack.
Exactly, but a change of the look of the pole car from qualifying to the race.
Off the top of my head, I can't think of one with a major change. I can think of some like Foyt 65 pole sitter had the oil tank was redone for race day over qualifications. But I'm at the moment, boy, there's a lot of poll winners to run through. I can't think of anything that had a major paint job.
That might be something to think about for the next couple of days, and you have to think of that.
Okay.
Did Eddie Cheever have the Rachel's potato chips at the beginning of the month? Was that added during the month?
That's a race winner, but...
It's not a poll sitter, but... was that there all month, or was that something added later?
I don't remember if he started out with the paint job. It was kind of a I think maybe he had the paint job, but not the sponsorship.
That's kind of what I was wondering.
The sponsorship was announced during the month.
That's what I thought too, and it was really kind of a smaller sponsorship. And look at the bang they got for that. They're on the Indianapolis 500 winner. Okay, that's all for tonight. Tomorrow night and Thursday night, email-only shows. We've already taped that and have already received more emails that we can handle. Donald is back here on Wednesday night with live phone calls. And don't forget, you can still get tickets through 1070thefan.com and wibc.com for tomorrow night's event at the IMS Museum. Donald moderating, looking back 25 years after the fantastic 92 finish. Al Unser Jr., Scott Goodyear will be there, and some surprises we expect as well. Yeah. Look forward to that. Look forward to hearing your recap.
Thank you.
For Donald Davidson and David Deering, I'm Kevin Lee. Thanks so much for joining us on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Playoff basketball is coming up next. It's Game 4 with Golden State and San Antonio.